dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. I'm very pleased to welcome back in a new capacity a man we've talked with often over the years, whose acumen and skill in the information warfare space in particular I have come to admire greatly. He is Dr. Michael Waller. These days, he is the Vice President of the Center for Security Policy for Government Relations, a new post and a very, very welcome addition to our team. He is, among other things, the author of Strategic Influence, Public Diplomacy, Counter-Propaganda, and Political Warfare, areas in which he is expert, as well as Meeting the Ideological Challenge of Islamism, How to Combat Modern Radical Islam, which he co-authored. Mike Waller, welcome back. It's good to have you with us. And again, congratulations on your new job.
Well, it's great to be back with you, Frank.
Let's talk first and foremost, Mike, about the hearing yesterday. Director Comey of the FBI was on Capitol Hill for hours talking about a couple of things, talking about the ongoing investigation, apparently, of Russian intervention in our elections and whether there was any collusion with Trump personnel on the one hand, and also the question of whether or not, as Donald Trump has contended, there were surveillance operations conducted against him and his subordinates at the campaign during 2016. I know you were traveling yesterday, but what are you making of where things stand at the moment?
Well, there was an extraordinary small amount of information that came up in the hearings as to what kind of fire may be behind the smoke. And for the FBI director to admit that there was an investigation taking place, but to practically acknowledge that there's no evidence of anything, was really extraordinary.
This is the kind of thing that we've seen a lot of, and needless to say, the Democrats were having a heyday as they were trying to make the argument that there is some fire there somewhere, even though people, including Mike Morrell, the former acting director of the Central Intelligence Agency, have said there's no sparks, let alone fire. Mike, there does seem to be a determination that there have been leaks, including against Mike Flynn. Do you think that that is likely to prove any more fruitful than leak investigations have in the past?
Leakers are almost never found, and when they're found, they're almost never punished. So I think there's going to be a lot of senseless chasing around about leaks, and that's the leaking of the news about hunting for leaks is going to make more news and draw more attention to the problem without solving it.
Do you think that there is, based on what you know and what you've been reading, among other places in the press, some grounds for a further investigation of whether or not Donald Trump was under surveillance at the behest of the Obama administration?
Yes, I think there is still grounds, because one of the holes in this whole thing is there's a presumption that the Obama people had a government agency do the spying. And so they're looking for people within the government to go through government procedures and ask government permission to use government assets to spy. And I don't necessarily think that if the Obama people did this, that they would have gone through the FBI. There are plenty of ways to do it privately.
Mike, let me ask you, you're an expert, among other things, on Russia and political warfare, both of which are very much involved in these allegations of its involvement in our campaign. When you look at the capabilities of the Russians, and for that matter, you know, the Chinese and other hostile powers, some very actively so, some certainly potentially so, relative to our own capabilities to use information operations, for example, to conduct influence operations overseas, Bill Gertz suggested that we've been unilaterally disarming in that space. What's your take on it?
Yes, I think even worse, we have unilaterally disarmed in that space, and there's really no more disarming for us to do because we've already done it.
Do you anticipate that one of the things the Trump administration will do is to rebuild those capabilities and start utilizing them more fulsomely? At the very least, is it your professional judgment that we better be doing more in that area?
Well, we better be doing it, yes, absolutely. I think the president understands it, and I think he has certain people around him who understand it. And curiously, some of those people are the ones who are drawing the most hostile fire from critics, as if to prevent them from not only succeeding in their job, but from surviving in their jobs.
Well, this is one of the things I wanted to talk with you about as well, Mike. Again, you have watched this at close hand, going back, I really think, to the Reagan years, and to some extent have been an instructor in the tradecraft of political warfare in various educational institutions around the United States. When you look at what we have been watching play out, certainly particularly since the presidential election was concluded, in terms of the kinds of, vilification attacks, I've been subjected to a fair number of them myself, but I'm interested in your thoughts about what's being done against the president himself, and most especially some of his senior subordinates. I'm thinking of people like Steve Bannon and Kellyanne Conway and Jeff Sessions and Seb Gorka, for example. Talk a little bit about what you see happening to those individuals and who's perpetrating it and what the purpose is, as you can best determine it.
Well, first, it's normal in any presidential transition to have different factions leaking against other factions and to undermine each one as part of a jockeying for power. And that's part of the game in Washington. And it's ugly, but that's just the way it is. The thing here, though, is you have an organized campaign to make the country ungovernable. And it's a really sick, devious campaign being waged with the personal involvement and sort of shadow leadership of the former president of the United States, Barack Obama. This is unprecedented. We've never had anything like this where a former president comes in and actively says he's going to do all he can to undermine his successor. Never had this before. So that's the biggest problem right there. And that's where you have the Ben Rhodeses and these other people of the world running these war rooms to not only snipe at critics here and there, or snipe at rivals, but to try to bring down a president and his administration by picking off the most influential and visionary people first, and then hopefully, from their point of view, to pressure this president either someday to resign in disgrace or to pressure him to put in people more amenable to Barack Obama's agenda.
Speaking of Ben Rhodes, again, as a student and as an instructor and as a practitioner of the art of political warfare, evaluate the role that he has played. Remind us, first of all, of what he did during the Obama administration and any further light you can shed on the role that he's playing now in the current Obama undermining of his successor.
Well, Ben Rhodes was Obama's top person in the White House on the National Security Council who was coordinating U.S. government strategy and the communications game around that, not just real strategic communications, but the game that Obama played here at home as well as worldwide to promote Obama's agenda.
The so-called echo chamber, as he famously called it.
Exactly. So he designed an echo chamber of people, sort of an amen chorus around the country, where they would leak to a news organization, and then the news organization would report it, and then the White House would repeat what the news organization said, and then other news organizations would report on what the White House said, and then there would be private groups and supporters and politicians throughout Washington and around the country who would then keep echoing each other
dominate the news cycle and all of that. Yeah. And this was, of course, most evident, and he actually came somewhat clean on having used this basically to lie about the Iran deal on behalf of President Obama. Mike Waller, we have to leave it at that for the moment. We'll look forward to having you back very soon. In the meantime, again, thank you so much for joining us at the Center for Security Policy as our Vice President for Government Relations. Next up, we'll speak with Stella Morabito. That and more straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. We're joined by Stella Morabito, a woman I've come to admire greatly for her thoughts and contributions to everybody else's about some of the public policy challenges of our time, particularly sort of the agendas of some of our adversaries as they are seeking through information operations, as we were talking about with Mike Waller, and propaganda and other techniques to shape our perceptions of what we need to contend with in this country. She comes to this by virtue of having been, in her past, an intelligence analyst with the Central Intelligence Agency, where she worked, among other things, on issues of propaganda and media analysis. She is also, these days, a senior contributor to The Federalist and a published author. We're delighted to have her with us. Stella, thank you so much for taking a few minutes.
Well, thank you, Frank, and thank you for that introduction.
We are confronting, I think, as Mike Waller just reminded us, a wave of efforts being made by assorted parties. I kind of think of it as the red-green axis at its head, sort of the red of the hard left and the green of the Islamists. But it comes in many forms. But one of the things that is very much a focus of effort, it seems, is a campaign of vilification designed, I think, at the very least, to malign people, including folks like myself and I think your good self as well, but also ultimately to silence us. And I'd like you to talk a little bit about this practice and where it seems to be coming from and sort of the traditional practitioners of it, as we've learned with hard experience over the years.
Well, I would say that history will tell us that if you look at any totalitarian system, one thing that they all hold in common is the effort to control all human relationships, all human interactions. You see this in Mao's China, in Stalin's Soviet Union. I mean, in North Korea today, it is typical to create vilification campaigns to control, to control the public, to keep people, to keep people from connecting
with one another. Our guest is Stella Morabito, and you were talking a little bit about how totalitarian systems have used vilification campaigns to control populations. Is that what we're seeing at the moment? I mean, this isn't necessarily a totalitarian.
Well, no, I mean, we still do have, our constitutional rights, but they are under assault. The First Amendment rights are under assault. I think, we can see that in so many different areas today. But it's something that should alarm us all, because just through the study of history and looking at how these things manifest themselves, like, for example, and I know this is, it may seem over the top to some people, but my grandparents were survivors of the Armenian genocide. And the genocide basically began, as all genocides do, with a vilification campaign. I mean, the Turks, my grandfather had good friends among his Turkish neighbors until this whole thing got underway. And if you look at how the Hutus in Rwanda in the 90s, That whole massacre of the Tutsis by the Hutus started with vilification campaigns that demonized them and identified them all as demons, basically justifying their destruction. It's a very, very dangerous kind of behavior to allow in a free society.
Now, Stella, let me ask you about this, because what is claimed by some of those doing the vilification of people like us, and for that matter, many senior people in the Trump administration, is that somehow we're doing exactly that kind of thing to Muslims, for example, and that we're setting them up for genocide, or at least what's now being called denationalization, whatever that is. Talk a little bit about this sort of practice as well of sort of deflection or transposition, if you will, of what they're doing themselves.
Well, absolutely. No, I mean, I think you'll find with all of these, with this whole phenomenon, this whole dynamic, is that there is a tendency for those doing the vilifying to project exactly their intentions on their opponents. It was done by the Turks, the Armenians. It was done by the Hutus to the Tutsis. It was done, any number of genocides, in Soviet Russia, in Stalinist Russia. The projection is typical of the kind of ways that how they defend that kind of behavior. Our founders understood the dangers there, and that is why we have Bill of Rights, specifically a First Amendment that would serve as a safeguard against that sort of thing.
But let me ask you about that, because that goes really to the heart of what I'm most interested in at the moment, Stella Morabito. I'm interested particularly in what we are looking at in terms of this technique of vilification as a means of effectively suppressing our First Amendment freedoms, to some extent by denying us freedom of speech, because we are no longer allowed to use Facebook and Google and Twitter, for example, if we violate somebody's norms, or alternatively, self-censorship. We refuse to say the sorts of things that we know need to be said because of fear that might happen to us. Explore those ideas, if you would.
Well, I think that what we end up with, and everybody should be concerned about this, absolutely everybody, is with the imposed self-censorship, through these so-called hate speech laws and the SPLC's absolutely ridiculous and dangerous.
Well, that's the Southern Poverty Law Center, of course.
Right. The Southern Poverty Law Center, it's just basically a smear organization. That's all it is. What you end up with, though, if you take this to its logical end, left to its own devices, we are all of us being marched into a virtual solitary confinement. That's really where it ends. That's the end point. And that's how you control people. You have, quote, community, which is really like a hive where everybody is separated in a cell and people are afraid to talk to one another about certain things. And that's really where it all leads. And people just don't seem to get that when you start imposing these kinds of, these kinds of restrictions on speech. I mean, I was just reading a piece today. It had to do with some, transgenders bragging about getting someone fired for not using the correct pronoun. And when I say not the correct pronoun, they were going into all these crazy ones like Z, Zer, Zem, Zun. I mean, and the person couldn't keep track. And there was a story about how they were, how happy they were that they were able to get this person fired.
But it does, at the end of the day, and this is what's so valuable, I think, about your historical experience and insights, is this is about control. And to the extent that we are losing freedoms at the instigation of those who are trying to exercise such control through vilification campaigns is a very worrying development. And again, I appreciate so much the work you're doing and exposing it and calling people to account for it. I hope you'll come back to us with updates about your research, Stella Morabito. Thank you for your time today. In the meantime, next up, we'll talk with J. Christian Adams. Straight ahead.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back. It's my great pleasure to have with us J. Christian Adams, a man that I first learned about when he was an election lawyer serving in the voting rights section of the U.S. Department of Justice. He came out of there, raised appropriately hell about what the Obama administration was doing, and wrote up much of what he saw and turned it into a best-selling book entitled Injustice, Exposing the Racial Agenda of the Obama Justice Department. These days, Christian Adams is, among other things, a columnist at PJ Media, and always a welcome guest here. Christian, thanks so much for taking a few minutes. Good to have you back.
Thank you, Frank.
Christian, I wanted, before we get into other matters specifically relevant to some of your past work at the Justice Department, to ask about a court case that you were involved in Guam. At a moment when most court cases aren't coming out very well, as far as I can tell, this one did seem to be a pretty good outcome. Tell us about it and what the next steps are, as you see it.
Well, Guam, of course, is where Anderson Air Base is, that regularly houses the nuclear bomber force and the only deep water port between Manila and Pearl. And an activist movement on the island started a separatist movement that was based on a status plebiscite. In other words, a vote to basically possibly call for the separation of Guam from the American orbit. And they limited the vote, Frank, as you'll remember, to only people who were native inhabitants, the Chamorro native population. So, of course, the vote was going to be rigged against, you know, the so-called colonizer was not allowed to vote. Well, this case started 6 years ago. I represent a Air Force major retired, and he challenged it as racially discriminatory. And finally, after 6 years, and many different detours, the federal court in Guam ruled that the Chamorro-only vote was racially discriminatory. You can't have a plebiscite about the island's future that only allows Chamorros to vote. So we won that case on summary judgment, and it's a very good thing for racial equality.
It does strain credulity that it could have taken 6 years to arrive at that perfectly obvious conclusion. But now that that conclusion has been reached by a federal judge, is that likely to go up on appeal to the Ninth Circuit? And if so, would you expect the justices there to engage in the kind of political agenda that they have on the immigration order, among other things, of late?
Well, I can't imagine that anybody who knows the law at all would suggest it be appealed. But if it is, it's an absolute certainty that the case will be affirmed because it's not really a close call. It is illegal in this country to give the right to vote based on who your daddy is. And the Ninth Circuit has already once ruled in our favor, and I can't imagine that somebody would waste the time and money to make it twice.
Well, that's encouraging. Christian Adams, it's my understanding that a similar kind of separatist effort has been underway for some time with respect to Hawaii as well. Is that the case? And if so, does your outcome have any bearing on what's likely to happen there?
Well, you're right. There's another effort in Hawaii and this has been going on for years, to basically set up a separate government, a native Hawaiian government, kind of like an Indian tribe. And, you know, that case is sort of ongoing. It appears every couple of years it moves along. Folks need to pay attention because this is not just sort of fluke. This is what happens to countries when they begin to fray around the edges. And, you know, Guam, Hawaii, obviously enormously strategically important, as the Japanese knew in December 1941. And, you know, both were attacked, by the way, on December 7th and 8th. 8th only in Guam because it was on the other side of the international dateline. So the first thing the Japanese did was attack Guam, Wake, and Pearl Harbor. And now you have separatist movements in two of them.
When you look at these issues, as you've indicated, Christian, this is not an accident. Who are the kinds of driving forces behind them? Are there people besides the individuals on the island, these activists, these separatists who are driving this kind of agenda with obvious, as you say, strategic implications for the United States?
Yeah, the people driving the agenda on the island are the usual rabble of university activists, anti-American activists. They stand in front of the naval base and the air base with signs saying, Yankee, go home. But they're wholly integrated into sort of the United Nations anti-American bureaucratic struggle that exists on an international stage. You know, they're frequently feted and dined and wined at international organization meetings, you know, with the usual suspects organizing the event. And so this is not just something that is homegrown. This is a wider fertilized effort on behalf of some other very, shall we say, unfriendly forces.
Christian, speaking of unfriendly forces, let me turn to another area you're expert in, and that is election fraud. You worked, as I mentioned, as a career lawyer in the Justice Department's voting rights section and saw a lot of what was going on, well, with the connivance, I think it's fair to say, of the Obama administration. But tell us, in terms of this ongoing controversy that President Trump has helped encourage, I guess it's fair to say, over whether there was voting fraud of any significance in the last election. What's your professional assessment of that?
Well, there's always voting fraud. The question is how much and how do we find out how much? And typically the left, their answer is we don't want to ask the question unless you know, the answer is what we want. They don't even do the hard work to figure it out. They hide and put smoke screens up in front of the facts. The other thing they always try to do is federalize things to make the federal government more powerful. And this is a security issue, Frank, because of our decentralized election system, it is easier, or I should say it's harder for foreign entities or bad actors to hack it. The decentralization of American elections, which is based on the Constitution, is a good thing. But what you saw at the end of the Obama administration was an effort to take critical infrastructure authority under various statutes and impose it on the election system. And I think folks need to be aware that a centralized election where Washington, D.C. has greater control is one that is a more vulnerable threat to bad actors.
Christian Adams, let me turn to one last thing quickly. During your time at Justice and afterwards, you were one of those warning about Tom Perez, who at the time was the Assistant Attorney General for the Civil Rights Division. He went on to be the Labor Secretary. Now he's been elected to be the Chairman of the Democratic National Committee. What do you anticipate he's likely to do, given his track record and agenda at the DNC, particularly with his wingman, Keith Ellison? Should we be concerned about their program and what its prospects are?
Well, you, folks need to understand, Tom Perez is a smiling radical who will say things like he wants to hear from everybody's view and makes a point that that's his MO, that he listens. But what he usually is doing is gathering intelligence on his opponent. So this is a guy who comes from the hardest of hardcore strains in the Democrat Party. He views the world through the lens of race and oppression. He is a muscular, not literally, but figuratively, political operative that believes in using the force of government to attack political enemies. You know, there is a circumstance where he went after a legislator in South Carolina using the power of the federal government just because the legislator had opposed Tom Perez's agenda. So, I mean, there's instance after instance where Perez represents the worst instincts of individual actors in a democratic republic.
Yeah, well, and certainly the Democratic Party will be watching as he wields its machine, again, as long alongside Keith Ellison. Problematic in the extreme. Christian Adams, thanks for what you do at the PJ Media, and of course your terrific book, Injustice, Exposing the Racial Agenda of the Obama Justice Department. Come back to us again, if you would, sir, very soon. Next up, we'll be speaking with Ned May.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. To SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
We're back. I'm very pleased to say we're joined by Ned May. He is the co-proprietor of a terrific, indeed indispensable, blog on the internet entitled The Gates of Vienna. There is really no better outlet that I know of for monitoring the sorts of developments in Europe that should be of concern to all of us. Ned May, it's so good to have you. Thank you for the great work you do at Gates of Vienna and beyond, and for joining us from time to time. It's good to catch up with you.
Thank you, Frank.
In particular, I wanted to sort of take stock with you about the current prospects as well as recent accomplishments of a mutual friend of ours, Geert Wilders in the Netherlands. He ran, of course, in the recent election, did not fare as well as some thought he might. But is that the end of Geert's career as you see it, or simply the beginning of an important new chapter?
I don't think it's the end of his career, but I don't think the Dutch will change course until there's some sort of, you know, systemic collapse, the breakup of the European Union, the collapse of the euro, things like that. Because if they didn't vote the PVV in this time, given what's been happening, they're just not going to do it.
Now, the PVV, of course, is Geert's party. And remind us who he is and what that party has stood for, Mid-May.
Well, here is the only leader of a major party who is standing up strong and consistently against Islamization and mass immigration into the Netherlands. And he left the VVD over the issue back in, I think it was after
2006, I think.
Yeah, it was after Theo was killed.
Theo van Gogh, the filmmaker who was murdered by a jihadist on the streets of, as I recall, it was Amsterdam, was it? In any event, he was an early sign of what was to come in the Netherlands and much of Europe, as you've been documenting at the Gates of Vienna. And so Geert took that party, which he essentially created out of whole cloth, and from being its only representative in parliament has now won 20 seats. And yet this has been widely described as a setback for him. Describe what actually happened in this election and the effect he had in the outcome and therefore on the future of the centrist party, the VVD, as you say, who has won this most recent election.
Well, the significant thing was how badly the ruling coalition lost. The top party, VVD, lost 8 seats out of 41, but the Labour Party was basically destroyed, lost 29 seats, more than 75% of their seats. So they're out of it now. And the new coalition will form. And yesterday, I think it was yesterday, Rutte, the prime minister, the leader of the VVD, said that he will not negotiate any place for Geert Wilders in the PVV in the new coalition. He's hoping for the Christian Democrats and D66, which are sort of mushy left. And I think they're going to throw the Christian Union in. They're the real Christians, unlike the Christian Democrats, to push their total over 75, give themselves a majority. But Geert is holding out insisting that he be included in negotiations. They've said they'll exclude him, and I don't know whether he'll ever succeed in that or not, but that's where it stood yesterday.
But I guess the main point, Ned May, is that the government of the Netherlands has been drawn more in the direction of Geert Wilders in order to stave off his challenge. And talk a little bit about the role that the Turks played, both in Netherlands and in Turkey, in this electoral outcome.
Well, what the Turks are doing is truly bizarre, and it's as if Erdogan wants to start a third world war, is the way he's been acting. His behavior right before the election in the Netherlands was the most provocative that you can imagine, and because the prime minister, leader of the VVD, took a hard stance against Turkey, he probably saved his party from a worse fate. And Erdogan responded to that with the most vicious and vile stuff, both against Germany and the Netherlands. He had one yesterday. We've subtitled it. I've got the subtitles here in front of him, what Erdogan was saying. They would gladly again put gas chambers and concentration camps back in their daily order of business, talking about Germany and the Netherlands.
Rather provocative stuff, at least for the Germans. And so this is all about, as I understand it, Ned May, and you followed these things very closely, of course, at Gates of Vienna, but the Turks are now in the throes of a referendum on whether Recep Tayyip Erdogan, the president, will be able to rewrite the constitution effectively to confer upon himself even more power. They've been enlisting Turks in Europe to try to get that change in the constitution enacted. And in the process, they've run into some opposition from people like Geert Wilders and even the government of the Netherlands. But where is this likely to lead with respect to Turkey's role as a NATO ally, for example, and the role of Turks who are now living in Europe?
Well, I don't understand why Erdogan, how he could lose this referendum since he's got tight control, but evidently he's worried about it, which is why he's going for the European Turks. European Turks tend to be more fans of his than his people at home. So if he can get a substantial portion of the expatriate Turks to vote for the referendum, it might put him over the top. But as I understand it, the latest polls show the no vote beating out the yes vote, just not by too much, but beating it, and which is, of course, unacceptable to him. I don't know what he'd do if he lost the referendum at home.
It would be very interesting indeed to see, and let's hope for that. Let me ask you quickly about one last thing. There's a gentleman by the name of Tim Burton, who I think we both know from a party called Liberty GB in the United Kingdom, who is now being prosecuted by the government there. Tell us what that's about and what it suggests is happening to freedom of speech in Britain at the moment.
Well, there isn't much freedom of speech left in Britain if you're going to say something about Islam or Muslims. You don't have free speech. And he came up against a group called Tell Mama, which is this Muslim lobbying group that watches for hate crimes and Islamophobia and then gets people prosecuted. And he saw an ad for, they were a job, a help wanted ad, and he applied for the job as a joke. And in his emails, he said all these insulting things against Fiaz Mughal, the leader of the head of Tell Mama, and called him fizzy bollocks, among other things, and something about a mendacious taqiya artist, just basic insults. And Mughal took exception to that and felt that he had been harassed. But instead of starting a civil lawsuit against Tim, he's an advisor to the Crown Prosecution Service. So he just called his friends at the Crown Prosecution Service and had the case started, the criminal case against Tim. And now he's going to court, and he could face up to 2 years if they put him inside.
Ned May, we have to leave it at that. I'm afraid we are hard out of time. Thank you so much for joining us and for the great work you do at the Gates of Vienna blog. I know you'll come back to us again soon, and I hope the rest of you will do the same again tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.